And I told Mr. Glam I would like to stay at Ford, and if he could match that salary offer that I had from Briggs, why, I'd rather stay. And he demurred and said he'd have to check. Came back a couple days later and said, nope, he just couldn't come close to that. So I made arrangements to leave the company and go to work for this engine project that they had there at Briggs Manufacturing over on Mack Avenue. So following my couple of years at Briggs and my couple of years in the Navy, I came back to Ford. But when I came back in 46, it was into engineering. So I never got back in the styling activity other than to go to the studios on chassis items and advise and approve and review and whatnot that would be involved there.
How did that happen?
Well, it was my choice, I guess.
It was your choice. Yeah.
And one of the things, while I think of it, that sounds pretty simple and dumb today, but it was something I thought was a real original idea of mine. The hardware on the back ends of cars was pretty much a blob here and a blob there, and the example that I can give you is that there was a handle with perhaps a key lock in the pivot of the handle to unlock and unlatch and lift the trunk lid up and push it down and latch it. Then there was a separate light for a license plate. Up above, sometimes the lights were, for the license plate, was part of a tail light that jutted out from the rear fender or something like that. Well, I got the fantastic original idea, mind you, of combining that license light and the deck lid handle into one assembly that was a little slicker and smoother and would put one unit on the deck lid instead of two or three others that weren't related. So I sketched up at home a handle with a license light in the top of it and sort of put it all into one shape and brought it in. And I think it was, I'm not real sure, but I think it was Bill Wagner that modeled the thing in its final form, and we got a combined deck lid handle and license light. Now, as an accomplishment, that's a big chuckle, but at the time I thought it was a big deal. See?
Was it adopted?
Yes, it was adopted.
What year did it show up?
Oh, God, I don't know, 1940 or something of that kind.
I remember that.
Something
of
that kind.
It was quite an innovation.
And the one picture that I don't find it in my stuff here, but I'm sure it's one in the file of a high angle view of the design department at that time, and it shows the bridges, and I think I'm at one bridge, Emmett Arrear is at a quarter scale model or something, and Bill Wagner is working on the back end of a Mercury, I believe, and he did the taillights and rear ornamentation, I think, for that either the 39 or the 40 Mercury, one or the other. And so anyway, that's how things got done then. The innovation could come from anybody, and not necessarily all from Gregory, but one thing, there was no darn schedule for completing certain jobs or releasing information to engineering as there is today. The whole design and engineering and manufacturing activity, as far as that goes, all the way through sales, is rigidly controlled by the calendar, and you might say you work backwards from when the dealers have to get their cars to introduce and hit the public at the right time. You work backwards through all the manufacturing lead times and eventually come out to where styling has to transmit this surface to body engineering by such and such a date, or it's the whole thing's going to fall apart. Well, there wasn't any such control then. And like I mentioned on that 41 Ford front end, I wasn't getting any direction, and there wasn't any schedule or anything that I was aware of. And today that sort of thing just wouldn't fly at all. But the war activity...
Before you leave the pre-war material, can you tell us a bit about Willis P. Wagner, who seems to have been an inspiration for you and a colleague?
Well, he...
A good friend.
He was a fellow I respected quite well, because I was I remember I was taking an engine course at college at the time, and I commented to him on the balance, inherent balance characteristics of the different engine configurations, straight six, V8, straight four, and so forth. And when I was commenting to him, he says, "Bud, I think you better check on that straight six again. I think you're off on such and such." Well, I went back to the textbook that night, and Willis P. was absolutely correct. And as I say, he designed the aluminum bridges that replaced those old mahogany jobs.
Can you tell us a bit about how that came about? That's quite an innovation.
It was, but that was done, I think, at the time Emmett and I first came over. I think we had a mix of bridges at that time. Some of the models were still in the old mahogany kick it along and wedge it in place bridges. And some of the new ones were there. Ultimately, they were all the old wooden ones were replaced with these aluminum structures, which were and I had been told that Wagner did it. And I think I, or Emmett and I, made up the sheet, a little 8.5 by 11 graph sheet that was printed, and it was a vellum. It was printed in any number of copies so that you could identify the model, the section that you were taking, whether it was transverse or longitudinal or what inch line it was, or whether it was horizontal as far as that goes. And then you could use the bridge and the different scales to measure these offset points, record them on the graph sheet, and give this to the body draftsman that would be brought in for that particular program. When we had a new model about ready to go, it looked like it was approved and the surfaces weren't too bad. Why, they would bring in two or three body engineers that were qualified for surface development, and they would, on these big horizontal tables, draft tables, lay out the sections that we would give them, measuring the offsets of the model. And they would proceed to use their curves and sweeps and whatnot to true up these surfaces. Well, it was all done by eye and by magic little keys that had been developed over time on how to get from such a section to another section and have the shape flow smoothly and not be full of bumps or whatever. And so what would happen is if Tom Stevenson, for example, who was one of the body engineers that was brought in, would be laying the surface out, he'd come back and says, "Hey, you got a flat spot in the rear door right about here." You could go into the model and feel it, and sure enough, he's most likely right, and you could actually work in a thin layer of clay and correct the model. So there was a back and forth working relationship between the body engineers and the modelers. And the other thing that I want to leave with you, Dave, is this folder that I've titled Old Ford Body Constructions, 1941. And what this is just a collection of sheets that I ran prints of and saved that were made by a body engineer named Binkins. And there's a couple of others in here, too. And what they are typical construction sections through an A-pillar, through the roof rail, through different parts of the body that would be made in conjunction with the clay model work. And the idea was to make sure that the thing we were modeling as a body was truly constructible by modern methods. The drip rail and the would mesh in with the top, and the glass seals and whatnot would all go together to confirm that the clay model we had done was truly a practical body engineering design. And so these key sections were made, and then we would pick these up and indicate the exact width of cut lines between the door and a quarter panel, or between the two doors and a four-door model, and something of that kind, so that when the clay model was primed and painted, all these cut lines would be practical. They would be the ones that the engineers would specify, and the painted model would represent what should come out as a final car. So these old sections, I guess, would be pretty hilarious by today's standards. I've got one in here that shows a quarter panel section with a nice running board on it. And you have to buy a sexy van today to get a running board. But they were part of the process at that time to do our job.
Well, thank you. That would be very helpful, quite an addition to our collection. One of the questions that John Najar posed for you was, when did you decide that you preferred to be an engineer rather than a stylist?
Oh. Well, I suspect, like other people, I was always bothered a little by the fact that I didn't have a clear idea as a youngster that I wanted to be a doctor or a dentist or a fireman or whatever. And when my mother succeeded in getting me into the Ford Trade School, I was really attracted to the mechanical drawing aspect, and I enjoyed the mathematics. And I think this actually goes back to the drafting and shop instructor that I had in grade school. He was terrific. He taught the shop subjects. I think it was Boyd. But it was at the, this was at the elementary school, it was the Marr Training School in Grand River. It's in a Northwestern High School group. And this was a training school for teachers, actually. We used to get, during a certain time of the year, we'd get young student teachers in there, good-looking young women, and the older permanent teacher would stay with them for a few days, and then she'd disappear, and the young ones would teach the class, at which time all the tough boys in the back row would make disparaging remarks and try to look down their dress when they'd lean over to help and things like that. But anyway, this guy was a great shop instructor, and he taught drawing and lettering and shop subjects, carpentry and how to repair home appliances and so forth. So I enjoyed that. And so when I got in the trade school, of course, there was kind of an engineering aspect to what we were doing. And I was made aware of this cash scholarship, or tuition scholarship, which Lawrence Tech awarded each year to a trade school graduate. And I think the reason that Lawrence Tech did this is that Lawrence Tech was founded in the Depression years by George Lawrence, who was head of engineering, I think, at University of Detroit. And it was founded at a real tough time for money. And Mr. Ford, I believe, let them use the old trade school building on Woodard Avenue, Highland Park, for $1 a year. And this is where I went to night school. All the 5 years I was there, it was up in Highland Park, the old ivory-covered brick structure. And so in reciprocation, I believe, Lawrence would give a 5-year night school tuition award to any trade school graduate that was selected by the trade school. Well, I decided to apply, and I had no more idea than the man on the moon that I'd win it, but I got it in 1937, so that paid my tuition all the way through night school. All I had to do was buy my books, which was a struggle. My mother bought my books, and engineering texts are still expensive as hell, but my mother bought my books 1 year because she got her kicks by playing the horses. And she was not reckless by any means. We didn't have enough money to be reckless. But she would join some of her girlfriends and get on the Greyhound bus and go down to Toledo and have an afternoon betting the horses and then come back. And this one time she hit a real couple of big winners and bought all my texts for Lawrence, for that year at Lawrence Tech. I thought that was pretty good. So I got into engineering by default, I guess. I didn't really think I'd win this scholarship. And the first term at Lawrence was, I always thought I was a pretty smart guy in school. But the type of trigonometry that was in freshman college there was totally foreign from what I had learned in the trade school. Practical trig versus theoretical Cartesian coordinates and so forth. And I really had to struggle. And the other thing was I'd been out of the habit of doing any homework for a year or two. And boy, I had to come back to earth there, because you went to school 3 nights a week. You had to do your homework on Tuesday, Thursday, and the weekends. And the blue books kept coming up all the time. So I really struggled that first term. Second term, I got on the ball, and then I think a couple of years there, I got all A's because I kept my nose to the grindstone. But I got into engineering rather than design or something like that, sort of by default, you might say.
Well, John Najar tells us that you, coming back to Ford in 46, that you were first assigned to specialize in chassis design, and that you were under the direction of a gentleman named Joseph Phelps.
Joe Phelps.
Can you tell me a bit about the, can you sketch for us maybe very quickly the atmosphere in the body engineering area of Ford in those days?
Well, Joe Phelps was one of the layout designers that I became acquainted with when the war started and the design department began to fall apart and everybody was assigned to some war project that knew how to do any drafting. Now, Joe was one of the, like a senior designer, and he made the most beautiful layout drawings that you could ever imagine. His lettering was perfect, and he had had all kinds of experience in the automotive industry. He worked at Duesenberg, and he worked on the Auburn car, and he came from Indiana. And so he was a top expert in the field of chassis design. And anyway, I got acquainted with him in those early war years when, as I say, design began to fold up. And when I got out of the Navy, why, I, like a lot of other fellas, was scouting around for a place to live and a place to work. And with the styling activity that I'd had, I went back and actually interviewed with one of the groups of Fisher Body. I almost went to work for them in a building behind the GM building. I forget what it's called now. But in interviewing, I also contacted Joe Phelps at Ford. And I found that he was a Lincoln Mercury chassis engineer, and why don't I come out and talk to him? So I came out and met Joe, and he introduced me to Jack Wareham, who was chief Lincoln Mercury engineer at that time. And Mr. Wareham explained that Lincoln Mercury division was really on the way up. They were going to build a new Lincoln Mercury plant. And
W-H-A-R-A-M.
And so Joe was willing to take me on as one of the designers, and he explained that they were looking for young men to expand their activity because there were new programs for Mercury and new programs for Lincoln and so on. Well, one of the guys that I met at Lawrence Night School, and one of the fellows that worked at Briggs and was influential in getting me in there, was a guy named Tex Ragsdale. Now, Tex was an orphan that has worked his way through school and graduated from Lawrence Tech, and was one hell of a good engineer. He was doing engine work there like all of us were. And Tex, after the war work pooped out, ended up at Turnstead, which was the hardware supplier division for Fisher. And Tex Ragsdale became, after time, became chief engineer at Turnstead and one of the high-ranking engineering officials when that was incorporated into Fisher Body. And so I got back into Ford through Joe Phelps. Now, Joe had us, a number of us new guys, working on the board initially, and Tex Ragsdale had done some studies on suspension work, and he gave me a copy of one of his papers and some of his drawings and referred to me to some of his texts, which I went through. And suspension work is terrifically interesting because it's an exercise in geometry The steering has to match the suspension, and so the wheels don't steer when they go up and down, and so on. And so it's an absorbing study. And the history of the development of the independent front suspension in itself is a is an interesting story. This was developed at GM, the Cadillac division specifically, and that's not a styling story, but it turns out that the basic problem with cars of that vintage that had solid front axles was when you tried to get the spring low deflection rates low enough so that the car had a low frequency motion on its wheels, the springs were so wimbly that they wouldn't control the axle adequately, and you'd get into vibration conditions termed tramp and shimmy, and these could get so severe that you'd have to stop the car and start up again because you were really totally out of control, and on a bad tramp, a wheel can actually leave the ground. It's just sort of stomping along like a guy bouncing from one foot to another. Well, anyway, I had done some study on suspension, and when I got into Joe's activity, that's what he put me on. We were Norm Downey and I were put on the layout of the front suspension for the first post-war Mercurys and Lincolns, the 49 models. They were originally scheduled to be 48 models, and all the part numbers had got 8M part numbers, but they didn't come out until 49 models. For a number of reasons. Well, let's see. The Mercury ended up, it was a design that was supposed to be a Ford. Mm-hmm. I think it came from, did it come from France? But anyway.
Well, but Gregory's
original. Was that right?
4940.
Well, it was obvious, I guess, to everybody there that that would never make a Ford because it was too big, mm-hmm. and it was too heavy and expensive, basically. And so that got pushed down the line to become the Mercury. Well, there were, for 49, there were two Lincoln models. One was based on the Mercury body with a Lincoln front end, extended front end, and Lincoln engine. And that was one fast machine. It had the big Lincoln engine in it, and it would go like a scalded duck, but it, as far as handling was concerned, it wasn't real great. And then the other Lincoln was a unique model called a Cosmopolitan. And anyway, Norm and I started on the layout of the front suspension, and pretty soon Norm got assigned to something else, and there were some space problems that came up on the layout, so I started a new front suspension layout, and that's one thing I did. And I also invented a sway bar that didn't have to have a link connecting it with the suspension. And I think the Chrysler guys had done that initially, but their design had a real long, crude-looking bracket to attach it to the frame or something or other. Anyway, Joe Feltz had an assistant. In fact, he had two assistants, as I remember. Hans Mathias was one of them, and Sid Frears was the other. See? Well, I was, Sid Frears was like the suspension engineer at the time, and I was doing layout work for him. So I designed this linkless sway bar and the front suspension for the 49 Mercurys and Lincolns. And that was a real interesting experience. It got put in production, and Sid was the guy. Sid Frears is Howard Frears' uncle.
How do you spell his last name?
F-R-E-E-R-S. It's Howard's uncle.
And Howard was?
Howard wasn't around there. I think he was, Howard was in the Army in World War II, and I think he came later into the company. I know Howard. Howard was in development work when I was in special military vehicles. And Howard had been in, I think, artillery. So he knew about artillery sighting devices. And we were working on this gun development contract, so we had a legitimate government contract under which we could request standard items that were necessary to do our contract work. Well, Howard was doing vehicle development work, and getting the proper drive shaft and axle pinion angles was a problem at that time on some of the cars. And Howard asked if we couldn't get a Mark III mod something or other artillery sight, which had a bubble level and protractor arrangement in that he was familiar with. So I remember I had an alibi to the contracting officer at ATAC that we needed one of these damn things. And it was because we were working on this helicopter gun and we were doing the ammunition shoot, and we had to make sure that the angles between the ammunition box and the gun at various positions was proper and so forth. And so we got this thing and I loaned it to Howard, and I don't think the Army ever got the damn thing back. But, they haven't come after me, so. Anyway, Sid Frears was Howard's uncle, and he'd been, again, one of these Indiana-type guys that had been in the automotive industry. And he's the fellow that impressed me with how important it was to coordinate the product engineering activity with the manufacturing activity. And he took me over to the Warren Avenue plant, where the suspension units were going to be assembled on a merry-go-round fixture, and we made a couple minor revisions and adaptations to our forgings so that they would suit these fixtures. And that's something that a lot of people in the company have just come around to learning in the last year or two. You just can't take an engineering design and throw it over the fence and expect the manufacturing guys to pick it up successfully and run. A lot of times they've got better ideas than what you might have on how to make something simply and make it reliable and so on. And talking about Joe Feltz, I always considered Joe to be a guy that the company could have written their personnel manual around. He was absolutely a square shooter. If you did your job, you never had to ask for a raise. He got you a raise. And he took good care of his boys, and everybody that worked for him loved him. On top of that, he had a good sense of humor. He wasn't an old tyrant by any means. And let's see, Joe, when he retired, he started the Ford Retired Executive Engineers Luncheon Club once a month. And he just recently, he passed away, I don't know, a year and a half or two ago. It's a shame, but Joe was one wonderful guy, and he could do the work himself. And I remember when we did the 52 Lincoln ball joint suspension, which I was project engineer on that, Joe had me go up to Port Huron to a company called Press Metals of America with him and the Press Metals representative, because Press Metals of America had supplied the prior type of steel threaded bushings that all the suspensions in the industry had, including Ford's, for a number of years, and this ball joint didn't use any of his threaded bushings at all. We had rubber bushing pivots, ball joints at the outer ends of the spindle, and so on. And so Joe took me up there, and we explained to the boss, Mr. Layton, that this development was coming along, and he better think of something like this that would use his equipment, because if the crystal ball was correct, this was the suspension of the future, and so on. Well, it turned out to be correct, but
were you the first company to use ball joint suspension?
In the United States, yes.
Where did you get the inspiration?
Well, it turns out that there were a couple of research projects going along in the research end of Ford. At the time, the need for a new Lincoln came on the scene. And I think Joe went over to the research guys to see what they had and what they were doing. And they were working with Thompson Products on one type of ball joint and another outfit called O&S Bearing Company on another design. And I remember the O&S representative used to refer to themselves as the obsolete and senseless bearing company. But they had a fabric type never lubricated type joint that wasn't any good. But delving into it further, it turns out that that's something that was explored back at the old days in Cadillac when they were first trying to improve the ride of the car and the steering stability at the same time. This was the reason that an independent front suspension was developed, because you could uncouple the steering so that it was not dependent upon the spring rates at all. It was all a function of the linkage, solid linkage that you had. And so you could get a very low front frequency by having very soft springs and get a ride that was flat instead of pitchy. And to do that, you had to have lower frequencies in the front than you had in the rear. And independent front suspension was devised to accomplish that. So you could say that the riding comfort was the initial initial need or forcing function that resulted in the development of independent front suspension. And this work, the pioneering work, was done at Cadillac. And at that time, I understood that they had experimented with a ball joint front suspension because they wanted pivots at the outer ends of the suspension arms.
What was that device again? A pivot?
Pivot.
Oh, pivot arms.
Which would allow the upper suspension arm to be in a swing in a different plane than the lower suspension arm. And the reason for that was that when you got real low front suspension rates, real soft front springs, and you would put on the brakes sharply for a fast stop, the front end would nosedive, would drop perceptibly, and this was a little disturbing. And they found that if they could vary the geometry of the upper and lower front suspension arms by having them swing in different planes, in other words, tilt the upper suspension arm, let's say up at the front end, why it would generate forces that would counteract this brake dive. And that was, again, counteracting the dive was the need which required the use of ball joints. Well, nothing ever happened with it at General Motors. And they were using the threaded bushings and parallel arm pivots and so on. And one of the first ball joint cars was the English, I think, XK120 sports car. Let's see, what's the make on that? Dave? Jaguar, yeah. And I can recall that we were working on this 52 Lincoln program when one of the suppliers that representatives that we had was from Canada and had taken delivery on an early XK120. And I was able to coax him into letting us bring that thing in the experimental garage. And we looked at the, put it on the hoist, looked at the front suspension, and of course it attracted quite a crowd because it was a new car at that time. And anyway, ball joints were used in Europe, but the 52 Lincoln was the first one to do that in the United States, and that set the pattern for the type suspension that came out on the 54 Fords and Mercurys. The reason the Ford and Mercury didn't come out at the same time as the Lincoln was that there was a total package condition in the front end of the car involving the engine, and the new overhead valve engine, whatever, for the Ford just wasn't ready. And that had to be delayed for a couple of years.
What year was this?
That would have been the 54 model. But the Lincoln was the 52. And I can remember that Mr. McPherson, who was chief engineer, felt that, who would want power steering? Gee, with a ball joint front suspension, you don't need power steering. But he had never, at that time, I guess, parked a car at low speed with the modern low pressure tires. I might make a comment on basic body design in the respect of unitized construction versus frame and body. Now, the most horrendous plan for failure program that Ford ever introduced was the 1958 model Lincoln and Continental. The reason I say that is that this was a long wheelbase luxury car, 131-inch wheelbase, and Mr. McPherson, who had come over from Chevrolet Light Car and was enamored of unitized construction for its efficiencies and in weight and so on. Overseas. And their light car, which didn't fly, which wasn't used, but anyway, it had been designed with a unitized body frame. And so this new Lincoln for 1958 was to have unitized construction. And we were working for Harley Kopp at that time, who had no real talent for managing people, in my opinion. But Harley had us, and I was, you might say, vehicle engineer at the time, had us maintain a continuing weight comparison during the development of that 58 Lincoln between unitized as it was being designed and what it would have been if we'd have used body frame. And of course the weight picture always came out in favor of the unitized construction, which went into production. However, one of the thoughts was that unitized construction would allow you to seat the passenger lower, and since you were getting rid of the frame members that ran around underneath, and would provide a lower overall car height, which seemed to be the accent at that time. And getting a low car was very important for some reason or other. And doing a unitized body and having it be successful on a short wheelbase is difficult enough, but when you got a 131-inch wheelbase on a big car with a 430 cubic inch engine and so on, it was asking for trouble. Now, on top of that, there was an entirely new plant to build this car, the Wixom plant. And there was an entirely new staff of people, from the production guys on the right on up through the plant superintendent. So if you're asking for failure, you take a radical new design where everything's new, you put it in a brand new plant with brand new people, and you're lucky to come out alive. And I think that's one program that taught the company that that's not the way to run a railroad. You don't introduce new products that way, especially if you're concerned about reliability. And the 58 Lincoln Continental, and the Wixom plant was built especially to produce that car. Now,
had you had any input into the Mark II?
No. Well, basically no. This was under Bill Ford and Harley Kopp at that time, and the group that were over in the old Navy barracks buildings. And I understand that Bill Ford had a golf green built there in one of the enclosed areas of one of these H-type barracks buildings, so he could pitch up to the green and keep his game sharp. And when I say I didn't have anything to do with it, the Mark II guys were always trying to use whatever Lincoln parts they could use to avoid special tooling, and especially being a bunch of cheapskates to hopefully avoid having to buy the expensive prototype parts. They'd rather let us buy a couple extras and steal them from us. So that's the only input to the Mark II that I can remember we had on that program.
Well, the 58 Lincoln was the one that you had
part
of to do that.
Well, yes, and Johnny Nager was running the Lincoln studio at that time, as I recall, because I can remember going over there and looking at the Continental model, which had a reverse backlight treatment, which could be, backlight could be lowered, you could get flow through ventilation, it was wonderful. And the 52 Lincoln convertible was a real slick machine, the way the top would fold down and stow itself automatically. So John Nager, with what he had to work with there, did quite a good job, I felt, on that car. The 58 Lincoln and Continental were all new. The only thing that was carryover were the wheel nuts, the nuts to attach the wheel to the spindle and to the axle, and that had a Model B part number on it. But everything else was brand new, so it was a guaranteed difficult program from the word go. And the body frame, from an NVH standpoint, provides in its body mounts, of course, an extra layer of isolation between the road and the passenger, which you don't get with a body frame construction. So in body frame, you have to be very careful that your body mounts are located in the right place and the frame has a proper rigidity and so forth, or you'll get a shaky car, which can be quite disconcerting.
What's the standard that you're quoting?
With body frame construction, why you have to be particular where your body mountings are located. They're like little pivot points in one aspect, and if you have too many of them and they're all bolted down tight in production as they should be, why you tend to distort the body and sort of strum it up tight, and which can give you all kinds of troubles for noise as well as door fits and things like that. If you have too few body mounts, why, the body itself has to have a pretty damn good sill structure or it's going to be bouncy, and so there's a happy combination if you're going to have a body frame system. And that's some of the art of development lies in tailoring the body mounts and the frame and body rigidities. Now, when you go to unitized on the body, the body lower structure has to do it all for rigidity. And your danger there is that all of the high frequency stuff from the road is going to travel right up through the suspension and into the car, and you get a noisy car that transmits all of the road roughness. Like a gravel road, it just drums like crazy, and so you have to use a lot of noise isolating type insulation in the body and dash in the doors and so on to get by. So beyond the styling and the structural aspects of bodies, you have those different methods of hooking it to the ground that come into the picture too. In 1971, was approached to take a foreign assignment to go to England. And Jack Hooven was the engineering boss in Ford of Europe at that time and came back to talk to me because evidently Hans Mathias had recommended I be considered for the position over there, and basically it was to go over and replace Connie Reuter, who was chief chassis and transmission engineer at Ford of Europe at the time, and it was about due for his assignment to be completed and for him to return to the United States. So I was nominated for this job, which I was happy to accept because our children were old enough to where we didn't have any problem there on moving out of the country, and of course there's no foreign, I thought there was no foreign language to learn going to England. Turns out that there's English, and American English, but I went over on a trip early, it must have been maybe April or May of 71 to check on a few, I don't know how, check on a few things which were supplier problems with parts supplied for the Pinto from English supplier. There was a clutch disc and a shift lever and a couple other things that I was going to review with the suppliers over there, and at the same time I thought I could get briefly acquainted with the Ford of Europe setup in England, talk to Connie Reuter, and then maybe scout around to see what things were like for finding a place to live. Then when we moved over to England, we found that there was no company home that was available that suited us and was appropriate. Normally, the company owns a number of properties, and the bigger ones are assigned to corporate chairman of the board and so on. And the smaller ones are for foreign service personnel like myself. And there just wasn't anything available, so my wife and I had to scout around to the estate agents and try and locate a place to live ourselves. And just one day in our nearest village there, which was Billericay, we stopped in an estate agent's place and looked at the pictures he had and told him what we were looking for. And he said, gee, you know, contemporary homes over here are just few and far between. Would you be interested in a period place? And I says, tell us, what's a period place? Well, he says, we got one that we don't even have our pictures out on the front window yet, but I've got the pictures here we just took. You're welcome to look at it if you'd like to. And what he showed us was pictures of a cottage that had been built in 1565 or earlier at the time of Queen Elizabeth I, and it was the cottage for a farm which had been auctioned off separately from the farm and modernized by the current owners, that is, modernized inside. And it was one of these half-timbered places with the black timbers and the white wattle in between and red tile roof. And so we arranged to go over and see it as the number one couple to look at the place, fell in love with it right away, and managed to stir up the Ford people enough so that they went and bought it for us. And this old cottage had been, as I say, modernized inside. The owner had put in a central heating plant and had built a modern kitchen in what used to be an old shed at one end of the house. And it was just a delightful old place. And it was about three quarters of an acre of ground, I think, the rest of which was in gardens where things had been planted over the years and never been taken out. So it had beautiful lawns and roses all over the place. So anyway, we found this delightful Elizabethan cottage to move into, which was just a short ways from the engineering center at Dunton. And we always liked it because we were in a neighborhood of English people, and we were not in what was referred to as the American ghetto, where all the other families had managed to locate. And the programs that were involved when we first went over there were the Tonus Cortina and the new Granada car, which was designed to compete with the Mercedes-Benz functionally and be more economical and whatever, which it turned out to be. The Granada was one fine automobile. In fact, about a half a dozen of the early production Granadas were shipped over to the United States, and from the word we got back, everybody that drove them thought they were great, and Mr. Iacocca was just dying to put it in production or import it into the United States. And we must have done about three studies on how much it would cost and how much time it would take to federalize that Granada so it could be introduced into the United States. Well, it turned out that all of these estimates were unfavorable, and I think they probably had plants that they wanted to keep busy in the United States anyway, so the result was that they created a Granada car in the United States, but it didn't compare with the European Granada at all. No. The European Granada had an independent rear suspension, independent front. It was unitized construction with one good, stiff, structurally sound body, and we had quite sexy rubber isolation mounts between the front and rear suspensions and the powertrain, and it was just a real fine automobile. You could zip around those English roads, which are the only roads that are straight in England, are the ones the Romans built and that are still being used. every other road is crooked as can be, and the technique driving on the left side of the road, if you want to stay alive, is to keep your left front fender in the bushes all the time. And so, the Taunus and Cortina programs were sort of in trouble from an NVH standpoint because the cars were originally designed at a certain car height. And as the story was told to me, Bunky Knudsen came over there and decided that car height was kind of old-fashioned and it ought to be dropped about 2 inches, which completely screwed up the driveline geometry. And the guys had been working very energetically to solve some of those problems. And it became kind of difficult because the same car the Cortina produced in England was, the identical car was produced in Germany as the Taunus. And the Taunus cars always sounded better than the Cortinas, or they sounded differently even though they're made out of the same pieces. And you go through a lot of that sort of thing when you're dealing with unitized construction. So those two programs were the most important. The one that turned out really good was the Granada. It was a real fine automobile.
Then you put into that
chassis. And I had fellows in Germany and people in England that reported to me, but all of the engineering work was done in England on our chassis things, even though the development, vehicle development work was done in Germany, and I had resident engineers over there and engineers at the proving grounds that were resident.
Why wasn't the Taurus platform, the Granada platform, introduced in the United States?
Well, I don't know everything behind the decisions, but there would have been an extensive engineering program to qualify it under the federal motor safety standards. The bumpers, lighting, and just about everything else, I guess. And as I say, the guys estimated about three different occasions what it would cost to do it, sent the estimates to the United States, and the answer came back, thanks a lot, we just don't think it's a thing to do. But I had heard that the reception was very favorable to the people that drove that car in the United States, and as like I mentioned, Mr. Iacocca was just drooling. He was just dying to have that car to sell in the United States at the time. It would have been a winner, no doubt. Then we worked on a Capri 2, and I might mention here that one of the features that the planners wanted to have for the Capri 2 were cast aluminum wheels. And there had been a special escort rally car over there produced by a small group, or put together by a small group, some kind of a special vehicle, sports operation, whatever. And these little escorts had the hottest 2-liter engine they could get in there, and they were painted a nice lavender color and had some proper names on the side, and they were a great hit with the rally crowd and won a lot of races. And they had used some aluminum wheels made by the GKN people. Well, when the plan, or the need, the desire, I should say, for a cast aluminum wheel on a Capri 2 came up, why, we scouted around to find out who was qualified to make something like that, because the choice of alloy and the soundness of the casting and whatnot is critical to the function of the wheel and the safety of it. And we checked back through service, and this little rally car never had any wheel problems, and GKN, who was the English supplier, turned out to be the only one in Europe, including the continent, the only one that was really qualified to cast and manufacture such an item. And we had our guys go through, and the quality control people and whatnot go through the GKN facilities and verify all of this, the processing and the controlling of the casting and the X-raying of the wheels and the machining of them and so on and so on. And so with Joe Orris on the styling end of it, and ourselves involved in the engineering of the wheel and a lot of help from GKM, why, we came up with this nice styled wheel for the Capri 2. And it had, I think, three different colors, two colors of gray and sort of a silver color involved, which was a tricky painting job. And it turned out to be a real winner, and the Capris were imported into the United States, of course. And when the planners saw those wheels on the Capri and the Lincoln Mercury dealers got a hold of them, of course, they were drooling to have some wheels similar to that on the other car lines, and this got the ball rolling. And our GKN source supplied wheels from Europe for some of our U.S. cars for a while. And then we qualified a supplier called Superior on the West Coast. And there was one eventually built, I think, in Mexico to make these wheels. And then the Alcoa people had forging equipment, and they supplied some forged wheels for the large cars, the Lincolns. And first thing you know, just about every car line had an option of a styled aluminum wheel, one kind or another, forged or cast. And you could look back and think that it all started with a crazy little rally car painted lavender, and here it became one of the money-making hits of the wheel industry over in the United States.
The Capri 2 never got any reason.
Oh, yes.
The
yeah.
2 did come.
Oh, absolutely.
The first.
Yeah, and it was interesting, at the time the Capri 2 was being readied for import, the cost people had done a study in Europe to see what they should price it at for shipping it into the U.S. And it turned out that with the exchange rates and one thing or another, the Lincoln Mercury people had been getting one certified bargain and been making money hand over fist on a Caprese in the United States, and Ford of Europe wasn't doing real well on it. And so there was a little consternation when the cost analysis really developed the facts on that, and they had to change the price structure, I think, on the Capri 2 as it was initially shipped in the United States.
I wonder, in the few minutes left, if you could give us the bird's eye view of the relationship between the body engineer and the designer.
And the stylist?
And the stylist.
Oh, okay. Well, the body engineer has to worry, I would guess, maybe primarily about how does the darn body component, all the components and panels fit together, and can they be assembled, can they be welded into an assembly adequately, and can the door fits and body fits for the deck lid and hood and whatnot be maintained. So the body engineer is concerned with the structural elements that the person ordinarily doesn't see at all. The rocker panels and the rails underneath and the door pillars and things of that kind that relate to the body structure, and how these various panels can be fastened together and sealed against the weather. Now that's pretty much independent of what the stylist looks at as far as the outside surface is concerned and as far as the interior trim is concerned. And there have been various schemes over time on the best way to assemble a body and get the fits right and so forth, which is still controversy is still going on today.
What develops the original package?
Well, it depends on whether you've got a vehicle engineering group that knows what its responsibilities are. Now, we've had vehicle engineering groups from time to time that didn't seem to realize what they were supposed to be doing. But the vehicle engineering group should dictate the package. And if the rear seat leg room or the headroom or something like that develops customer complaints, it's really their baby, nobody else's, because the stylist, the designer, the clay modelers, and all those guys work to those critical dimensions of interior headroom, let's say, in getting the contour of the roof. And they're the ones that really have to provide the specifications that the designer works to.
Had you gotten the original proposal from the product planners?
Well,
or did you work together with them?
A lot of us felt, and it depends on how old you are and what your prejudices are, but a lot of us felt that product planners were like tits on a bull. And really, their function is more profit planning than anything else, and acting as gophers for the division general manager, be it an Iacocca or a Ben Mills or whatever.
Or Gene Peterson.
Yeah. Now, all product planners aren't idiots. I don't mean to say that. Because they are supposed to be responsible for the economic profitability of their assigned car program, and bringing the car program into being within budget and on time is quite an accomplishment. If you've got a planner that knows what he's doing and he's got the responsibility and authority that should be given to him, why, he can be quite a important guy. At Ford, we've had all kinds of product planners, and I myself felt that product planning came into existence merely as a staff function to give the first head of the Ford division the power to control his own products. This is, what's the guy's name? He was a bean counter at GM, and he used to live in Northville. Can't think of his name offhand, but he was the first guy that was put in charge of Ford division. And very logically, he didn't feel that engineering, which at that time was determining what the hell the product was, engineering should determine the product that he was expected to merchandise and make money for the corporation when he didn't have a damn thing to do with it. So he generated this group of